budgets, health, services first.
Revenue.
To confirmation of, right after that, and also the ABC and corrections. Commissioner Pugh, welcome to House Finance.
Health and Social Services.
Will be chaired by myself, but Engelberry. And
on the Senate side.
That particular, will be Senator Ferguson, Spakes, and Catula. The committee is ready to hear your presentation this afternoon, Commissioner. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is John Pugh, Commissioner of Health and Social Services. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the House Finance Committee. It's a pleasure to be here today to give an overview of the department, both from the standpoints of its programs as well as the FY86 budget, which governor's budget, which is before you. The budget that I will describe today represents many months of effort. It's one that I put some real confidence in the fact that we have scrutinized it. It definitely has put, the department staff has put a lot of effort into it. Obviously, with the talk of declining revenues, there certainly will be some debate as time goes on about which of the projects and initiatives in here are the most valuable, and we will have to look at those priorities as the session goes on. In the governor's budget this year, there is $331 million for the Department of Health and Social Services, an 8.6% overall increase over the FY85 authorization of $305 million. This increase does not represent maintenance of existing service levels in departmental programs through the addition of an automatic cost of living. In fact, the only significant cost of living amount in the budget is the $4 million for negotiated salary increases, which affects our 1,700-plus employees. Instead of attempting to maintain a comfortable status quo in the department, I chose to place the highest priority on funding a number of significant initiatives representing new or expanded services in critical areas in the state. The governor concurred with this approach in his recommended budget, and I will describe these initiatives at a later point. First, I'd like to briefly describe the department's various programs, and then we'll get into the initiatives. The department is divided into two major sections, the section of social services and the section of health. In the section of social services, we have three divisions: the Division of Public Assistance, the Division of Medical Assistance, and the Division of Family and Youth Services. In the section on health, we have the Division of Public Health, the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and the Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. In addition to those six line operating divisions, we also have two support divisions and a support office: the Division of Budget and Finance, the Division of Planning, and the Office of Personnel. The Division of Public Assistance is responsible for administration of seven major benefit programs. They include aid to family with dependent children, old age assistance, aid to the disabled, aid to the blind, food stamps, general relief, and energy assistance. The division's budget authorization for FY85 is $78.3 million. The governor's FY86 request is $87.1 million, an 11.3% increase. The total division staff authorized in FY85 is 279 positions. The division has staff located in 20 different locations, actual office locations, and in addition, we have fee agents in 165 additional communities to take applications. The division will serve approximately 25,000 families in fiscal year 86, consisting of approximately 50,000 persons, Alaskans, or roughly 10% of the state's population. So roughly 10% of the state's population at some point in time accesses our public assistance programs. The Division of Medical Assistance, which was formed last spring in April of 84 to administer the Medicaid, General Relief, Medical, and Catastrophic Illness Benefit Programs. These programs provide financing of the medical care for various categories of persons determined eligible by the Division of Public Assistance. The fiscal year 86 budget request for these medical programs is approximately $83.5 million, 7.4% above the FY85 authorization of $77.7 million. In any given month, nearly 24,000 Alaskans are eligible to receive medical care under this program. From 6,000 to 7,000 Alaskans do actually receive medical care during any given month. Approximately 70% of all the persons served by the division are children, most of whom are also receiving state financial assistance under the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program. The Division of Medical Assistance has offices in Anchorage and in Juneau. Their major offices are in the Anchorage area, and as I mentioned, it's the major job there is the payment of providers and not any direct staffing as in the Public Assistance Division. The Division of Family and Youth Services, the third social services division or section of the section, administers programs within two general categories, social services and youth services. Social services provides protective and support services for children and adults who are at risk of abuse, neglect, and exploitation. And youth services are services which promote public safety and reduce risk to citizens by preventing and correcting delinquency among our youth. The Division of Family and Youth Services provides services statewide through 50 offices and 4 youth facilities. The total number of division staff is 453. In FY86, the division plans to serve over 28,000 clients. The division's total funding request for FY86 is $57.9 million compared to $53.2 million authorized in FY85, and that's an 8.8% increase. The Division of Public Health is responsible for administration of 21 programs in 6 program areas. These program areas include the Public Health Nursing Section, Communicable Disease Control, Family Health, Laboratory Services, Health Grants, and a new program added last year, Postmortem Examination. The division provides public health services through contractual arrangements and state-staffed public health clinic facilities and offices. The division has 17 offices located throughout Alaska. The public health nurses actually itinerate from many of these offices to almost every community in Alaska. The division staff authorized for FY85 consists of 300 positions. The division also contracts with the Manilik Association and the Norton Sound Health Corporation and with the North Slope Borough for additional health services, mainly nursing services, but also other additional health services. During FY86, the division estimates that 184,000 individuals will be screened, tested, immunized, treated, or counseled, and that is an unduplicated count. And so approximately almost 40% of all Alaskans access our public health programs throughout Alaska. The Division of Public Health's FY85 authorized budget is $33.4 million, and $35.2 million is requested for FY86, an increase of 5.6%. The Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disability administers the following 5 programs: Community Mental Health Grants, Community Developmental Disabilities Grants, Acute Inpatient Psychiatric Services, Inpatient Psychiatric Services for the Criminally Mentally Ill, and Intermediate Care for the Mentally Retarded. The division at present has 458 authorized positions located in offices in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau, and at the 2 institutional facilities operated by the division, Harborview Developmental Center in Valdez and Alaska Psychiatric Institute in Anchorage. In fiscal year 85, the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disability has 25 contracts with private agencies to provide services designed to prevent institutionalization and improve the functional level of developmentally disabled persons. The division also is funding 26 locally controlled and operated community mental health centers throughout Alaska. In terms of the 458 authorized positions, the vast majority of those positions are at Alaska Psychiatric Institute and Harborview in Valdez. The rest of the programs in mental health are granted out or contracted to local community nonprofit agencies. The FY86 budget request for the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities is $43.1 million, a 10.7% increase over the FY85 authorized amount of $38.9 million. The State Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse is responsible for administering alcohol abuse and drug abuse programs, for which the FY86 budget is $17.3 million. This sum represents a 4.9% increase above the FY85 authorization of $16.5 million. The Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse conducts business through the grant and aid process. The office provides administrative support and technical assistance, as well as program monitoring, with 11 employees in Juneau and 7 employees in Anchorage. The Juneau office serves as the administrative, budgetary, and fiscal control point, while the Anchorage office serves as the monitoring and technical assistance portion of the operation. These programs will serve approximately 11,000 clients in FY86. Department of Health and Social Services also, in addition to these 6 line agencies, has some general administrative offices. Services are provided in those general administrative offices in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. The general administrative offices have 122 positions authorized in FY85. These include such things, though, not only as general administration, but also fraud investigation, vital statistics component, the division of planning, and the division of personnel. The clients in these, what we call administrative divisions, are often the other divisions and offices in the department, but also, as I mentioned, they do serve some of the general public. Vital statistics actually interfaced with 45,000 different Alaskans during last year and providing some services to those Alaskans. Our personnel office received, in the first half of FY85, has received over 1,600 applications that we have process for recruitment and examination. That's a new aspect in the department this year, where we're doing our own processing of applications for positions that are specific to the department. The governor's FY86 administrative services budget is $7.1 million. At this point, what I'd like to do, as I mentioned earlier, is turn to the major initiatives which account for most of the FY86 budget increase. As I mentioned, we did not just take a cost of living across all the programs, but instead I chose to put the money into some particular initiatives which we felt were significant problems in across the state of Alaska. First initiative, in the Division of Family and Youth Services, the administration is launching an attack on a problem which you have been hearing a great deal about recently. That issue is child abuse and neglect. The problem of child abuse and neglect has become a matter of increasing concern in Alaska. There's been significant increase in public awareness of the problem, exemplified by substantial attention in news media, increased public inquiries, and increased attention of the legislature. However, the most significant indicator of public concern has been the increase in reports of harm to children and the demand for intervention and services to protect those children. Since 1978, there has been a 173% increase in the number of persons receiving protective services. The total caseload for the Division of Family and Youth Services has increased from 4,000 in 1978 to over 10,000 in 1983. The number of reports of child abuse and neglect requiring investigation and services has risen dramatically. That, in fact, the rise has been as much as 219% over that same period of time. There has been particular public interest and increased incidents reporting also in the area of sexual abuse of children, and which have occurred not only within the family, but also in daycare centers, as well as other out-of-home care facilities. And this also has increased the caseloads in the department. Despite the increasing demand for protective services, the primary service resources, social workers, licensing workers, the clerical support staff, have not been increased proportionately over those years. In 21 of 36 Family and Youth Services field offices, social workers have average caseloads exceeding the maximum caseload standard of 50. In 7 of these offices, the maximum standard is exceeded by 100% or more. Staff has become overburdened. There has been an increasingly high rate of staff turnover, errors of judgment, and an inability to implement policies and procedures. As a result, there have been increasing complaints, increased agency liability and litigation, and increased third-party oversight by both the legislature and the Ombudsman's Office. To address these problems, the Family and Youth Services FY86 budget request contains 3 major increments to provide increased service to child abuse victims in the state. The increments are comprehensive packages intended to increase the level of protective services to acceptable, though not optimal, levels. The increments totaling almost $1.9 million in general funds fund 31 full-time, 8 part-time staff. These are all not only social workers and licensing workers, but a substantial number of clerical positions which have been recommended not only by our people, but also by the legislative audit staff. In addition, we also provide an increased level of attorney support for court proceedings and allow specialized training in the area of child abuse and neglect for new and existing staff. 20 of the positions will be located in South Central Region, 12 in the Northern Region, and 7 in Southeastern Alaska. In addition, the Family and Youth Services formula-funded foster care program is requesting an increase of $1.5 million for FY86. The division experienced dramatic growth in foster care placements in FY84 as a result of the treatment emphasis on the less restrictive nature of foster care and a no-growth approach to costly residential care. Just a sideline, I think this has been a policy basically that has been one which we have worked with the legislature on for not only the FY84 but the two previous years also, the no-growth concept for residential care and the expansion of foster care. The increase in child abuse cases has also necessitated an increase in foster care placements. In FY84, the division was funded for 535 full-time equivalents, which basically is a placement which would go for an entire year, even though there may be two children in a placement. Full-time equivalent equals a bed for an entire year. We were funded for 535. However, total full-time equivalents for the year were 614, an increase of 15%. Reappropriated fiscal year 83 juvenile custody funds were used for those full-time equivalents, which exceeded the FY84 budgeted level. Initial indications for FY85 are for a 9% increase in full-time equivalents, and a supplemental has been requested through the governor's office. In FY86, the upward trend in foster care is expected to continue, and full-time equivalents are projected to increase to 677. The FY86 increment represents the funding required to provide the projected level of statutorily mandated protective care to both delinquent minors and children in need of aid. In addition, in Family and Youth Services, two other agencies in the juvenile justice system transfer responsibilities to this division in this budget. The Department of Corrections has moved the women inmates from the Johnson Human Services Center to the Lemon Creek Jail and has turned that facility over to the Family and Youth Services. We have renamed the center to the Johnson Youth Center, and the facility will operate as a regional intake and detention facility here in Juneau. Although there was $601,000 in 8 positions transferred with the facility and 2 existing positions also were assigned there, 4 new positions are being requested to provide the 24-hour coverage for up to 18 youth in that facility. The division also accepted responsibility for juvenile court intake in the 3rd and 4th Judicial Districts, a program formerly run by the court system. With the transfer of responsibility came adequate funding, and the department is not requesting any additional funds for the juvenile intake area. Moving on to the Division of Public Health, Division of Public Health is requesting a series of increments addressing rural health care. Despite advances in recent years, access to both routine and emergency care remains limited for many residents in rural Alaska. Because of distance, climatic conditions, small population groups, and costs, the most practical solution in the foreseeable future is to increase on-site capabilities to provide definitive treatment for most common illnesses and to provide stabilization and referral for more complicated conditions and injuries. This will be achieved through better training of community health aides, installation of clinics staffed by mid-level practitioners in some of the larger rural communities, and improvements in training and equipping of personnel trained in emergency response. The governor's budget includes increments of $515,000 for community health aid training, $140,000 for mid-level clinics, and $475,000 for emergency medical services in rural Alaska. Public Health is continuing also to fight against hepatitis B and is requesting an additional $75,000 to vaccinate non-native Alaskans who are at high risk, particularly children. At this time, the majority of high-risk rural residents have been screened, approximately 46,000 of them, and immunizations are well underway in the Bethel, Bristol Bay areas. Laboratory services are continuing, though, at a level of about 1,200 tests per month. An additional problem in the public health area has been an increased cost in vaccines for communicable disease. The governor's budget funds $216,000 increment to allow the Division of Public Health to distribute an adequate amount of vaccines to health providers. It is necessary to maximize the vaccination rate in order to avoid major outbreaks of vaccine-preventable diseases. The cost of prevention is minor compared to what the public health cost would be for treating such outbreaks. In addition, the governor's budget does retain several important legislative additions to the FY85 budget for the Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. These include $352,000 for the Alcohol Safety Action Program, which was added in the House last year, $423,000 for general alcoholism grants, $450,000 for youth drug prevention grants in rural areas, and $242,000 for the Municipality of Anchorage Drug Abuse Services. In addition, the severe alcoholism and alcohol abuse problem in Bethel is being addressed in an increment of $300,000 for a detox services in the Bethel area. In addition to that, $363,000 show up in the budget as an interagency transfer from the Department of Corrections, which will fund substance abuse counselors for the state's correctional institutions. Many inmates continue to be jailed for alcohol-related crimes, and adequate counseling is a necessary part of that rehabilitative process. I think this was the result of Representative Clarkson's action last year. In turn, moving on into the areas, some of the areas of public assistance, medical assistance, I'd like to talk a minute about the formula-funded programs, which always are some of the highest increases within the department. The formula-funded programs represent a very significant impact to this department's budget in fiscal year 86. In the Division of Public Assistance, the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program has been faced with an unusually high caseload increase during calendar year 1984. An 11% increase in monthly caseload from 5,340 to 5,973. This impact is somewhat addressed by a $5.5 million increment in the current FY86 budget, $2.8 million of which would be state general funds. However, the anticipated leveling of these caseloads expected during the last quarter of calendar year 1985 has not taken place, and we are now faced with a supplemental request of $4 million for FY85, 2.8 of which would be state general funds. We are currently working with the governor's office on a projected FY86 budget amendment for an additional $4.6 million on top of the $5.5 million increase already included in the budget, representing an overall FY86 general fund increase of $5.1 million. This program is one of several in which legislative intent has indicated that we should not reduce the services as a result of the unanticipated caseload increases. However, this is not anticipated by anyone, the rate of increase in this program. Adult public assistance programs have also displayed unanticipated caseload increases, especially in the area of aid to disabled program. These increases, 10% in 1984 for the disabled, resulted in a last-minute increment to the governor's budget of $319,500. While this increment is small in comparison to AFDC needs, our most current caseload information leads us to believe that the adult public assistance programs will continue to subject us to increased funding pressure during 85 and therefore during 86 as well. The Medicaid and General Relief medical formula-funded programs and the Division of Medical Assistance are responsive to caseload changes in the assistance programs. A budget increment of $5.7 million, $2.9 million general fund, is needed to provide for anticipated FY86 increases in Medicaid, both caseload increases as well as the cost of doing business. While our FY86 projected increased need in general relief medical is $2.1 million, the governor's budget could only provide $610,000. The governor, however, is planning on introducing a bill during this session which would move prescription drugs out of general relief medical and into Medicaid. This would result in a $1.4 million savings in state funds as federal Medicaid funds would become available at a 50-50 match ratio. The Department of Health and Social Services had special problems in providing moving into mental health, has had special problems in providing appropriate long-term services to Alaska's criminally committed clients, as well as to transfers from correctional facilities. Historically, the department contracted with institutions in Indiana and then in California, Tascadero in California, to provide services for the not guilty by reason of insanity persons, which we often call NGIs. This tenuous relationship ended in 1980 when overcrowding legal problems forced California to cancel our agreement. As a result of both the NGI population and the correctional transfers, Alaska developed an 18-bed secure treatment program and a 14-bed psychiatric security unit at Alaska Psychiatric Institute. This has created, over the years, a significant problem with Alaska Psychiatric Institute in that it has had to become more secure to handle those, both the NGIs as well as the correctional transfers, and has moved slightly away from its original intent, which was to be an acute psychiatric hospital. Our recent accreditation done by the National Accreditation Agency has indicated that this is a real problem in the hospital. Although we were accredited, they made recommendations again about the fact that the units ought to be moved off of the campus of Alaska Psychiatric Institute. As a result of that, we have in the budget an initiative to move the forensic unit from API to Highland Mountain. We know that this has been hotly debated, particularly in the Eagle River area. My understanding is last night the advisory board for the Highland Mountain facility had voted unanimously in opposition to this move. But in the budget, there is a $1.7 million request for the movement of those beds from API and the creation of a 40-bed unit at Highland Mountain. We will be, I'm sure, looking at alternatives as we go forward, given what we're hearing from various legislators, but it is in the budget at this point in time. Also included in the community mental health grants budget are continuation of services that were provided by the legislature to Transitional Living Center in Anchorage and also the community mental health services on the Prince of Wales Island. In addition, there is, as a response to the plan that was recommended that the department do for the legislature on the developmental disabilities, there is two increments for $1.1 million for the developmentally disabled in the community placements, residential training, vocational training, and respite care, and this would serve an additional 135 clients. These are the major initiatives that impact on the department as well as a large number of Alaskans. Most of those citizens are the most vulnerable, the poor, the handicapped, and children, or they're individuals who have less access to adequate health care, such as rural Alaskans. The governor's FY86 budget for the Department of Health and Social Services, when we began, I think, is a reasoned approach to this in the sense that we did not attempt to totally maintain the ongoing services, but to try to hit some of the major areas of growth and population growth and caseload growth that we've seen in the department. I would like to bring to your attention one item of concern which is not addressed in this budget but could have fiscal impact, and that's the current proposal concerning the amendment to the longevity bonus program. Continued receipt of the bonus for many older Alaskans makes significant numbers of these ineligible for our state and federal cash and medical assistance programs. If we were to look at a hold harmless for these individuals that are presently on our programs, we have estimated a cost of $3.1 million. This would fund replacement benefits for those individuals expected to lose those benefits. And again, that is not has not been cranked in the budget because we do not know what the outcome of that will be. But I appreciate your attention, and those are the major initiatives, and certainly I'm open for questions, and we do have a handout of a book which details each of the division's programs as well as the major initiatives in it.
Questions to the committee? Mr. Cotton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things real quickly. Did you say that the governor is for sure going to introduce a supplemental for AFDC and for GR-Med?
That's correct.
When's that going to happen?
My understanding is supplementals are due by January 28th, and my understanding, January 28th. I'm trying to remember the date.
Reverend Cotton, hopefully we'll have might have a copy for you on next Tuesday. Which those two you have just...
The other point I think you covered pretty well was that, and that was the transfer of the NGIs from API out to Highland Mountain. And I've had conversations with the commissioner and explained to him that I'm not in favor of that transfer and hope to be working with you to explore alternatives, and including Spring Creek, which was designed as a maximum security facility. And when it comes online, I think would be better able to handle it. I think that the treatment nature of the facility at Highland Mountain would be threatened and changed by the move that has been proposed here. But I am encouraged by your apparent willingness to search for alternatives. And I assume that I can be assured that this budget request would have to be approved before you took any action.
That's correct. Well, that we have no way of funding that without the budget request, and I recognize that, and that's one of the reasons that I did put it in, though. It is a major problem. We are overbedded at API by 20 beds. This would significantly help us in terms of relieving that, as well as, of course, moving those individuals to secure facility, which has been recommended by a number of task forces. But, again, I recognize that it is an appropriation matter, and we will work with the legislature to determine what the best way to meet those needs are.
Real quickly, you mentioned the advisory committee from the Eagle River area that did meet and disapprove or express their opposition to this move. And I just wanted to say about that committee that they aren't a group of reactionary-type people, and they've got a very good reputation of handling things without the immediate emotion that some people might think that a group like that would. That's not how they've been performing. So I take their recommendation very seriously, and again, looking forward to working with you on alternatives.
President Frank?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, with regard to the longevity bonus, those benefits that are potentially going to be lost, is it a dollar-for-dollar lost benefits, or is it a situation where because they get the bonus, they lose thousands of dollars in benefits? Or could you elaborate on that?
There's two problems. One is that, as many of you know, that last year the federal government ruled that anybody who was not a 25-year resident could no longer be exempt, or no longer would the bonus be exempt. And so at that point in time, what happened is anybody who was under the 25-year limit as of September of 86, but any of those individuals no longer qualify for the exemption, and therefore their amount of money has to be counted as income. And so what happens is, when that's counted as income, many of them are kicked off of the programs. And what we're indicating here, some would not be kicked off, so we're not talking about a dollar for everyone, but we're talking about those individuals who would, in fact, be removed from the Supplemental Security Income Program, as well as those individuals who would lose their Medicaid benefits, which we have identified 800 who would lose their SSI and another 300 who would lose their Medicaid benefits. The third piece is that we have at least 39 individuals right now in nursing homes that would lose their benefits. And, of course, if we do not hold them harmless, we are going to have to quit funding them. And at this point, many of those individuals would have to be moved to nursing homes down south for families to afford that. So there's a total of in that of somewhere in the neighborhood of about 839. The 800 also includes the 300 on Medicaid, but the 39 are in nursing homes or a separate group. And the hold harmless would do is basically keep everybody's benefit at the same level as they were before this decision came from the feds, and would allow continuation of medical care.
Commissioner Myoff is supposed to get a hold of you to make yourself available next Thursday at 10 a.m. for the majority caucus to discuss some of those things on longevity bonus. Representative Rieger.
One other question on the longevity bonus, based on what you just said. Is that my understanding?
The courts
will allow the federal government to treat old-time residents and new-time residents differently, but will not allow the state government to do so. Is that
To be honest, Representative Rieger, that has not been, has not gone to the courts. I think there's some question whether that would hold. But the problem is that for us to take it to the court might well mean that what would happen is all those 25-year residents that are being exempted at this point might lose their exemption, and of course that is not something that we would want to test. And so at this point, our feel is that at least we have some exemption for Alaskans, which is more than any other state has, so we've not been willing to test that.
We can go back on the AFDC. Did you say that there was a supplemental and also an additional request and a revision to the budget for next year?
That's correct.
And that was 2.8 million general funds plus another 4.6 million general funds?
The entire general funds, additional general funds in the operating budget for next year, I think if I was right, was $5.1 million for FY86. The $2.8 million supplemental for this year for FY85.
And they add together 7.7.
That's okay. Correct.
And then the last question, just on the Highland transfer, even if wherever it goes, whether it's Highland or someplace else, is there a cost savings at API that corresponds to the 1.7 million, or is that just additional money?
Well, at this point, you know, in the budget, our attempt was not to do that because we do need the beds. We're at 196 residents at API. We're licensed for 176, and we need the beds that would be vacated by the transfer. And so at this point, we are not reducing any of the staff at API. We're opening new beds. So it's not only opening 40 beds in a sense that at Highland Mountain, it's also opening an additional 20 to 34 beds at API by leaving the staff that are presently handling correctional individuals there. So there is not an offset of at API for that program in the budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The administration made substantial cuts in the social service block grants for Anchorage and Fairbanks, about $400,000, I think, for Anchorage. What was the rationale for that?
Well, my understanding in terms of the block grants were not originally in the budget submission from the department. And the reason for that was that when we went down the list of needs that we had, given the amount of dollars that was available to us in the budget, we felt that the block grants were not mandatory in the sense of the other programs that we were funding. When we got into the debates about the budget, the governor was willing to look at adding the block grants in, and when at the end of the budget process, that was the amount of money that was available, and he felt that that was all that he could afford within the governor's budget and keep it at the 6% level.
Just one follow-up question, and this isn't leading you, it's just we were given some impression by briefings from social service people in Anchorage that there isn't a relationship or an interrelationship between people who may get a block grant through our block grant program versus who may come to you anyway. And is that right, that the block grant may save some monies that might come through to these same groups through other of your programs? Is there any
There's not a great deal of relationship on that. For example, the Latchkey program that is funded out of the block grant in Anchorage, that's the only, to my knowledge, the only program funded in that way throughout the whole state. Many of the programs, additional programs, are ones that do not fit into our basic grant programs in mental health or alcoholism. Some of them do. There are some of the programs that we fund that also get funding from the block grants, but I would say that's not a substantial portion of the block grant funding.
Thank you very much.
Representative Larson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question in relation to the criminally insane prisoners again. First of all, when you're looking at alternatives, I hope if you consider, say, the Palmer Correctional Center as an alternative, that you hold about at least a dozen public hearings in Sutton. Second, though, and more serious, how many of those criminally insane prisoners do we have approximately in Alaska?
Well, we have 21 residents right now who are not guilty by reason of insanity. Now, that category of individual no longer exists under the statutes. That was prior to the change. I guess it's 3 years ago now. Of that group, just to give you some indication of what they're in for, 10 of those individuals have committed murder. Another 7 of those individuals are in for assault. 2 of those individuals are in for rape, and another one is trying to remember. I don't remember the other one, but they are significant in terms of behavioral problems in the past as well as mentally ill. So But additional to those, and I mentioned, is we also handle right now what is known as correctional transfers. If an individual is in a correctional facility and has acute psychiatric break, then they are placed in API. And so not only do we have a secure unit, 20-bed secure unit, for what's called not guilty by reason of insanity, but we also have a separate secure unit of 14 beds to handle correctional transfers. And so that, in addition, in the overall population, we have about 34 beds at API right now that are handling those individuals.
And those 34 then will be transferred to Highland or some other alternative?
Not all of them would be transferred, but a good portion of those would be transferred. In some instances, we would still, because of the review of the court of those cases, we would have to go through a review process with treatment teams and determine whether that was still in the best interest. There may be individuals who still need the high level of treatment in terms of psychiatric treatment at API who would remain, but a good portion of those would be transferred.
I guess some of my concern is like Representative Rieger's. If we're transferring, say, 30 people, we're going to hire 45 new ones to take care of them, but yet we're not reducing any of the staff at API, which is presently doing that, that somehow numbers just aren't adding up for me.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned, the reason that is that our plans, it's a dual situation. We're overpopulation at API, as well as we have basically a real demand on that facility. That facility was built in the mid-60s, and we have not added any beds in Alaska for psychiatric beds in Alaska since the mid-60s. And what we're looking at is not only taking those out, reopening both those units with the staff that are there to take acute psychiatric cases. So the staff that are at API will remain on those units, and we will continue to utilize those beds, but we won't be using them for not guilty by reason of insanity or correctional transfers. So that's the reason there's no offset of the staffing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ewing?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, I've noticed under one particular section of the budget here, under developmentally disabled, there's quite a bit of a transferring that's been going on in grants and so on from various other departments. It all seems to be going over in that direction and being burdened onto that particular department, which increases it. What kind of leeway are you making in other departments that you need to transfer everything over to that particular area?
I'm not clear now. What we did do some transfers from public health
right. To
the developmental disabilities area. Now we've attempted that. I guess this is the third year running. The reason there has been some money that has been going in for daycare in the Anchorage area, and also for respite care in the Anchorage area, and then respite care in the Fairbanks area, that has been run through as sort of designated grants into public health. That is not where we administer those programs within the department. We administer those programs in the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. So each year in the budget, we come back and put them back in the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and each year people move them back into public health because there are some questions of the groups that have those grants that do not want to be administered by that division. I still feel strongly that the expertise for administering those grants is in the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and we have once again moved those grants into that division's budget. And we feel like we can not only administer them better there, but we can also provide more technical assistance and so on in that way.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the one, as you're right, you're correct, the one area I think was respite care, which is currently a pass-through grant for the municipality of Anchorage, which goes to the Catholic Social
right.
Services.
There's some concern that if it was moved to the Division of Developmental Disabilities, that they would restrict who could be served in that. And I have mentioned last year, and I will assure again, that we won't do that. If the grant goes through in the same fashion, we won't restrict who is to be served in the sense of what their concerns are. In Fairbanks, it's the same. Right now, the Fairbanks Respite Program doesn't just serve children, it also serves adults. And the rest of the respite programs throughout the state only serve children, developmentally disabled children. Fairbanks serves developmentally disabled children as well as substantially handicapped adults. And I will assure that those services continue. It just makes sense to have them administered from the program that is administering the other respite care programs in the state.
One last question. Representative Pershaw had questions about the social services block grant. Is it true that a lot of those block grants went to nonprofit sort of agencies and that kind of thing when they were administering?
They definitely went to nonprofit agencies. The only area that I'm aware that some of it did not go would be in Latchkey. I think some of the schools may have gotten some funds in there, but the majority of that block grant did go to nonprofit agencies.
I just wanted, continuing, I just wondered why you were cutting something that cutting that back significantly when then maybe they can provide the services a lot more inexpensively or more efficiently than just moving that to some other kind of a departmental agency.
Well, we're not moving. I guess it's not a matter of moving. It was a matter of priorities, and we ran out of money. The services that those block grant agencies provide are not duplicated in the budget in another area. They're addition to what I would call basic services that are in the budget, the basic grants. For example, there's mental health. We have a grant with the mental health agency in Anchorage. Well, in addition to that, there are a couple of counseling agencies that provide, quote, family services in Anchorage, which are could be considered in some instances to be mental health services in the broad sense, and those are funded out of those block grant funds. However, in the mental health grant program, we are funding directly that local mental health center. There are 26 of them. We're funding that center, and we chose in the past. We had had some objections to the municipality taking our funds and using them for other agencies other than the basic mental health program, since our basic mental health programs are really short-funded around the state. So what the block grant provides is additional funds on top of what I would say are basic funding levels for whether it be mental health, social services, other kinds of programs. And it does not mean that I don't feel that those programs are important. It just means that given the amount of dollars that were available in the budget, it was not possible to continue to fund them at that level.
Thank you. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the fraud division or the fraud activities are being shifted from your administration over to public assistance. That probably is a policy call, which you can probably explain. But one of the things that I've had a lot of concern with by and I think it's general public concern, is your ability to really perform adequate fraud investigation and enforcement. I see that, it's in a $1.5 million range that you're funding that area at. How effective really is it? And are you getting the job done? And what has to be done to strengthen it? Because I've got some real concerns as to whether or not you're getting the job done.
Quite frankly, I would say that our fraud investigation unit over the years has done very miserable in terms of its record of particularly prosecutions. We did have a period of time about approximately a year and a half ago where we were able to get the proper legal services from the Department of Law and get a series of prosecutions in the area of fraud, and I think that operation ran real well for about 6 to 8 months. Overall, we're still having difficulties getting the kinds of legal services that are needed to operate a fraud investigation unit to the level that that I would be satisfied with in terms of response. We are presently looking at and do have plans that we have sent to the federal government of the possibility of actually moving the fraud unit to the Department of Law. That is one of the situations that we're looking at and turning it into an investigation unit in the Department of Law in order to get it out completely Department of Health and Social Services to have a more objective viewpoint of the whole fraud investigation section. I think it also would enhance the legal services that we would get. We have talked to the federal government. They're willing to up the match to 75% on the food stamp side for all the prosecution services, and we think we can actually increase the amount of services provided if we can improve the whole level of support from law and get more prosecutions. It's one of the areas that the federal government is quite concerned about, too. And they fund most of the money in the fraud unit, not the state.
Mr. Chairman, follow up on that. The concern that seemed to be cropping up during some of the preliminary reviews that I've done is indicated that your fraud division just doesn't have the muscle or the ability to act as an enforcement agency. In other words, you've got people who can do little or nothing except for if they have a cooperative client who wants to spill the beans on themselves or their cousins or relatives or whatever is going on, then yeah, then you go out and you can prosecute. But if they don't, and you got a pretty savvy clientele out there, I mean, the population out there really knows how to waltz you guys around the corner. Is there anything we can do to strengthen that to make it any better?
Well, I personally think that the biggest issue is prosecutions. We have had a very low level of prosecution rate, and because most of these fall in the misdemeanor category, and the Department of Law has a significant amount of felonies facing them and have not been able to give the attention to this area. And so what we're trying to do is get some dedicated resources from the Department of Law into this area, and we feel if we can get our prosecutions going in the area, it will result in public information out to people that are trying to look at these cases and be tough on them and so on. We also need to improve our administrative hearing level in this, and we are going to attempt to do that also with this transfer. But I am not satisfied with what level of response that we've had in this area.
Thank you.
Gibson, Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the block grants, Fairbanks and Anchorage, I noticed that Anchorage is cut by 13.7% and Fairbanks is cut by 33%. I'm just wondering what the rationale on the allocation of the cuts were.
I can't give you the full... My understanding is, like I said, the governor's office put the block grants in at the last moment. My understanding is they basically did it according to how much money they had. I don't know the rationale why 33% in Fairbanks. The one thing that I did know that in Fairbanks there had not been any issuance of grants at that point in time. They still had the entire $750,000 sitting in their bank account. There had been no RFPs out or anything when we were developing the budget.
Representative Clarkson.
Thank you for allowing me to ask questions, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the largest increase in this budget that I've seen so far is the FDC caseload and the resulting increase in the Medicaid program. Could you discuss for us a minute your perceptions of why that caseload has increased much higher than either the department or the legislature felt it would last year?
Well, I think there are a number of factors that are involved in the increase in the AFDC caseload. First, in calendar year 80, the federal government made a significant change to the AFDC law, which resulted in a significant reduction in the caseload. We went from approximately 6,500 clients down to 4,900 clients in that year per month. And that had to do with structural changes in the AFDC program. Nationally, what is being found on the research is that those clients have gradually begun to come back into the system as the economics have worsened nationwide. The structural changes, which were in the neighborhood of small amounts, you know, $100 here, a couple of $100 there in terms of resources, has made the difference now with the economics that a lot of those people are coming back into the caseload. I think we're seeing that a number of those people who dropped off back in 80, 81, 82 are beginning to show back up into the caseload. That's particularly true from what we can tell in rural Alaska, that we're not seeing a huge population increase in rural Alaska. We're just seeing some people coming back in. Also, there is some indication that there is economic problems around the state in terms, despite the amount of capital projects out, we have a large unemployment rate. And we do have some correlation between large unemployment rates and the increase in our caseloads. And so we are seeing some increase, I think, due to those economic conditions around the state. Thirdly, particularly where the largest caseloads are coming, which is in Anchorage and Fairbanks, we've seen a significant population increase. And any time we have a boom in the population growth, we also have a significant increase in our caseloads, both in AFDC and food stamps. But one thing I would comment to is that despite those increases, we still fall far below the national average for the amount of individuals on AFDC. We are about half of what California is in terms of the percent of individuals on AFDC. So despite our increases, we are still holding our own in the sense that we do not have the numbers on the public assistance programs that other states have seen.
Can I follow up on that? The second reason, which is the economic picture, we just got the report that said that the unemployment rate is a point lower this year than it was at the same time last year. It doesn't seem to be consistent with your suggestion that it's the deteriorating economy in Alaska that may be increasing this.
Representative Clarkson, though, if you look at our numbers, where we experienced the increase, we started seeing our increase last year in January, and it picks up all the way from last January, you know, calendar year ago, all the way through the summer with a slight dip at one point, which we normally have had, and then it begins to climb in the fall again and has climbed every month since then. So our actual increase has started last year, and if you remember in our testimony, we said we were concerned about that because we were seeing some increases last spring while we were testifying before the legislature, and we had hoped, as we had indicated then, that there would be the normal leveling in the summer. That never came, and those increases have continued straight on through the summer and right on through the fall. We've had every month we've had an increase in caseload in AFTC.
Mr. Pugh, there will be many questions, and if there's any members here that have questions on HESS, Representative Clarkson and I and Hurley and Pingler, we'll be working on it. We'll be working on the supplementals. We'll be working on the cost savings of splitting up the public assistance into public assistance in two divisions, which is cost savings and public assistance. We'll be trying to justify the 39 positions and also trying to help the population cause in Eagle River. But if you do have any questions regarding these things, please bring them. We'll be meeting once we get the schedule together, starting at 7 a.m. in the morning till 8:30, and some afternoons from 3 to 5:30. And we thank you and your staff for joining us this afternoon for your presentation. Commissioner, good luck. Commissioner, welcome to House Finance.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased to be here. We are prepared to make a presentation of the budget overview. I'm going to ask for the indulgence of the members of the committee. I have held the position of Commissioner of Revenue since mid-September, and in that period of time I've attempted to familiarize myself not only with the budget but with approximately 14 other agencies with which I must deal on a daily basis. And as a consequence, what I did was satisfy myself that Bruce Patello, the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue for Taxation, and Irvin Jones, our Director of Administrative Services, are thoroughly familiar with and confident to answer all questions. I will assure the members of the committee that I have gone over the budget with them. We have discussed the policy issues that are involved and the numbers. But in fairness to you and in recognition of the short period of time in which you have to deal with these matters, I am requesting that, as to the budget presentation, you allow me to defer to Mr. Patello and Mr. Jones.
That's fine, Commissioner. We're going to do it in two phases. Is here the budget. We're going to have an informal confirmation hearing on you. As you know, the five-day rule, we'll take it up on Monday and sign the report, not only on yourself, Commissioner, but on the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. And the committee that has been appointed to the Department of Revenue is Representative Frank, and Representative Ewing on this particular, so they'll be working with you. Commissioner, you can have any one of your staff make the presentation however you feel.
Fine, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll call Mr. Patello.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, it's going to be somewhat difficult to follow Commissioner Pugh's presentation, very thorough. What I'd like to do to begin with is simply give you an overview of the major functions of the department and indicate to you in brief summary those increases over our FY85, that is current year budget, so that you have an idea in very short summation of the major changes that we have before us. We have seven online divisions that are managed through the Commissioner's Office, which has responsibility for overall management of the department. The current budget provides for 16 positions in the Office of the Commissioner. In addition to the management, we have two other functions that are unique to the Commissioner's Office. The first is our research section. You've previously heard presentations by Vince Wright, who is our Chief of Research. We also have a hearing officer staff Unlike most departments that have administrative hearings under the Administrative Procedure Act, we are exempt from that. We maintain an in-house core of hearing officers who are specialists in tax law and who rule on appeals made by taxpayers to determinations of tax liability. In addition, the Commissioner's Office, primarily the Commissioner, serves on various boards and commissions. There are, I think, a total of about 15 that she, by statute, she or her representative serves on, the most important of which are the Permanent Fund Corporation, Alaska Industrial Development Authority, the Permanent Fund Corporation, the Municipal Bond Bank Authority, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Multistate Tax Commission, and again, there are numerous others which she and her staff within the Commissioner's Office are responsible for. With regard to our line divisions, I indicated that there were and are seven divisions. The first is our Administrative Services Division. It is, as is the case with most departments, the centralized services of personnel, payroll, supply, and data processing. In addition, however, our Administrative Services Division is responsible for administering our shared taxes program and also for doing the data capture of all of the permanent fund dividend applications. We also have the Audit Division, which is our primary division for the majority of our state tax programs. Their responsibility is, again, to ensure compliance with those tax laws. They have taken responsibility for the oil and gas corporate income tax from 1981 forward. They consist of 65 full-time employees and one permanent part-time. The Child Support Enforcement Division is our largest division, consisting of 93 full-time employees, and again, their job is to obtain and enforce child support orders. Probably the most important significant change in that area during the course of this year has been federal legislation enacted effective August 16th of 1984, which required, among other things, the establishment of a state child support enforcement commission, and that is an activity that we're currently engaging in to, again, review the child support enforcement program of the state to make recommended changes in both our methods of administration, but also propose legislation as necessary. Our Petroleum Revenue Division is the primary division for administering taxes dealing with non-renewable oil and gas resources. They also are responsible, that division, for audits, royalty audits on behalf of the Division of Natural Resources. And finally, that division provides for petroleum revenue forecasts. You, again, have heard presentations by Dr. Charles Logsdon in conjunction with Mr. Wright and the Subcommittee of Finance this morning. Heard a presentation by the division director, Fred Betch. Our enforcement division is responsible for two major activities, that is, collections of taxes that are due, and that would also include management of escheated real property of the department. They also provide investigations within the Department of Revenue, criminal investigations for tax fraud, as well as permanent fund dividend fraud and general investigations as to eligibility for the permanent fund dividend program. That division consists of 23 employees who are funded out of the general operating budget non-permanent fund dividend program. The Public Services Division is the primary division interacting with the public. We provide public service counter services for the general public, and people may come in for licensing, for bonds, for taxpayer assistance, obtaining, as an example, business licenses or fish and game licensing. The other major program that is managed by Public Services and which is highlighted in our budget increases for this year relates to games of chance and contests of skill. That division is responsible for the enforcement of our current gaming laws. Finally, we have the Treasury Division, which is, in essence, the state's bank, and its charge, subject to law, with the responsibility of getting the maximum return on all of the state's investment portfolios. In addition to our online divisions, we have several instrumentalities of the state which report to the department or are part of the department for at least administrative purposes. the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, which again will be a subject of presentation early next week, the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Those are, in essence, the basic operating entities, units within the Department of Revenue. With regard to our budget requests for this year, ours, as is the case, I believe, with most of the state departments, has been a hold-the-line budget within the governor's guidelines. We are asking for increases in of a total of 12 positions. Those are as follows. We are asking for three positions within the commissioner's office to fund two hearing officers and a special assistant. Now, these are not new positions. They have currently been funded out of the special oil and gas appropriation which the legislature has made. We believe it's more proper that they be reflected in our operating budget as part of the commissioner's office, and that they be funded by appropriate interagency receipts. We have requested six positions in public services for our games of chance and contests of skill. Those would consist of three investigators, two tax examiners, and a clerk typist. Again, our current licensing enforcement program until this last year has been almost non-existent. The department initiated a general review of that program last year and concluded that we have major problems in the area, particularly with regard to operators, that there is a great leakage, there is a great loss in state revenues, not taking into account the serious loss of revenues to the charitable organizations for which the gaming laws were initially enacted. We are also requesting one document processor for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. They have not seen any increase since 1977 in their staffing, although in fact they have seen something in the neighborhood of a 33% increase in their overall license applications. We've asked for one accounting clerk in public services to administer the water conservation, that is the duck stamp program. And finally, we have requested one clerk typist for the Child Support Enforcement Division to process interstate ERISA cases. We have an obligation under both state and federal law to receive petitions from other states requesting our assistance in locating and establishing or modifying and enforcing child support orders. Those are the personnel increases within our budget. There are, in addition to these, several increments, most of which relate specifically to merit pay increases or other increases related to payroll. Other than that, the major significant increase, again covered, however, by federal receipts, deals with the Child Support Enforcement Agency, and that is attempting to establish an interstate information exchange with five other states, primarily in the Northwest. Mr. Chairman, I recognize that this is just a very brief sketch, not in dollar terms, but attempting to summarize for you the programmatic changes in our budget for the following year. I think I would conclude my basic comments at this point and permit you, Mr. Chairman, and your committee members to pose any questions with regard to those dollars, and we will attempt to field those questions.
Thank you. We've looked at municipal assistance and to see that earlier in January you estimated that you put a figure in that was 98%, given the fact that last year was a drop in revenues between 300 and 500
dollars.
What figure have we come up with, the new figure for municipal assistance
at this particular time?
Did you recalculate that yet?
Mr. Chairman, if I could defer to our, we have not done any recalculation, but with regard to the general program and where we are at this point, I would defer to Urban Jones, the director of that program.
Mr. Chairman, based on the latest forecast in January, at the full 30% formula, as it's generally thought of, the full amount of funding would be $95.7 million, which is about $8 million more than what is currently in the request.
If I may add to that, the governor wanted to stay within the 6% overall, and so was adding an increment of 6% to that one, which brought it within less than 2% of the whole 30%.
Okay. The some of this member served on budget and audit. We looked at an audit last year with the Child Support Enforcement Agency. That audit was completed on May 31st, and its recommendation that this agency should cease staff expansion and reassess its staffing needs. Has the agency done this yet?
We're, in fact, very much in the process of doing so. We've requested the Office of Management and Budget to do a thorough review of our agency. We have not hired those positions at this stage, but primarily because of the lack of space. We are, however, also doing a thorough review. We have recently changed directors of that division. Holly Plug was appointed effective December 16th. She is also conducting an internal review of the operations of the division.
Questions of members?
Just one question on the funding for the permanent fund dividend program. When that bill passed, I think when a bill passed in 1982, dividend, there was a hold harmless for people who would lose other assistance payments. And that shows up not in your budget, but in the Health and Social Services budget. Was it ever determined for sure what the source of funds was for that hold harmless? Is that clearly general funds, or is that also supposed to come out of the pool of money for the permanent fund dividends?
You've got me. Irvin, do you know that one?
Mr. Chairman, at this point, and I haven't really been talking to anybody about it in probably just 6 months, but I tend to agree with that. There's been some discussion about that, and the determination was that it was general fund.
Okay.
Representative Cotton.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think I was thinking about something else, and I heard you say something about duck stamps, and I wasn't sure what. Could you tell me a little more about that?
Mr. Chairman, our department is, through the Public Services Division, administers the duck stamp program. That is, we sell the duck stamps to our public services county.
Do we have a state duck stamp now?
Yes, we do.
Yes.
I know that you always had to buy one at the post office, but I didn't realize the state had it.
They're just starting.
Mr. Chairman, that program was, I think, an enactment of last year's legislative session.
Okay. The other question I had to do with the gambling education enforcement program. Apparently, that's an increase that. And my notes here, I wasn't here last year, but I have a note here that says this program was introduced as a bill last year, but was vetoed. So I guess I don't understand how this whole thing fits together. If the governor vetoed a bill, and here he is asking for the same program now in the budget.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, the problem last year. And those representatives present may recall that the legislation was passed very rapidly with very little public opportunity to participate, very little public notice. The governor was very concerned because in the intervening time he was besieged by persons and organizations who believed that they had not had an opportunity to give appropriate input on the legislation. He chose to veto the bill simply and solely because he believed that there should be more adequate opportunity for public scrutiny and also for an opportunity for the department to meet with those interested organizations to try and come up with a more suitable bill. And there were certain things that we had not taken into account. That legislation, again, will be introduced on behalf of the governor with some changes, which we hope will indicate an improvement, in fact, over the bill, which did passed last year.
Mr. Chairman, may I add to that? Existing law provides for regulation of games of chance and skill. Notwithstanding the existence of any new law, the existing law requires an enforcement effort which we cannot fulfill adequately to our mind under existing circumstances. And we are requesting additional investigative services to ensure that even under existing law, if nothing is done, that the charities who rely on Games of Chance and Skill to support their charitable efforts will indeed get their fair share from the proceeds, and that the people who are able to play the games and desire to play the games can do so in an environment which is appropriate under the circumstances. And it's simply a recognition of terrific growth in primarily bingo games and a necessity for regulating and policing those and to make sure that the state receives likewise its fair share.
I think more on that later is going to be in order, because there's
a
lot of questions I have about that, but it'd probably be more appropriate. The administration is going to introduce a bill
on
this?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I might also indicate for the committee that we have spoken with the subcommittee chairman for revenue and indicated that your subcommittee, and indicated our willingness to have a presentation made by our chief investigator, and at this point our only investigator, to enlighten you on some of the problems that we have with the current statutory scheme.
Representative Ewing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 10, or I believe 12 new positions that you talked about, I can understand the situation with some going into the investigation on the Games of Chance and Skill that was discussed this morning in the subcommittee. However, I also noticed that there was a decrease of 5 positions to a total of about $82,000 in your audit department. Perhaps you could explain why we're going to be decreasing in the audit department. Is this because there's a decrease in the workload?
Mr. Chairman, we made over the course of the last year an assessment of the workload in that division. I believe we had several positions that had been vacant, and made the decision that we could best reallocate those resources within the department, which we have by and large done. As an example, and we mentioned it this morning, as I recall, the creation of a department training officer. We have also used a position to establish one other hearing officer within the department in order to take care of what we consider to be a fairly serious backlog. In essence, Mr. Chairman, what we've attempted to do is, rather than ask for additional positions and allow you, the legislature, to believe that we have a need for the full 63 in the audit division, made the decision to reduce the best we could without without exceeding the governor's instructions to us to keep our budget request within the 6% guideline. I'm not sure that I've directly answered your question.
On another issue, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was also an increase of over $250,000 just in the commissioner's office. Was that mostly for personal services, or what exactly does that entail?
Mr. Chairman, most of that increase, Representative Ewing, is related to the personal services and the increases of hearing officer. For example, there's also a public information officer involved. And most of them come about in the adjustments between the FY86 FY85 and the FY86 adjusted base. It's those intra-agency transfers that take place. And then there's also an increment in there which was funded through transfers within the Department of Personal Services money to cover such things as expected merit increases.
Representative Larson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On municipal assistance, I just want to get some of the numbers straight here. The 30% level, say, as of the was $95.7 million, was that it?
Mr. Chairman. No, sir, the 95.7 that I referred to is, I'm sorry, you're right, it was based on January, I was thinking back last year, based on this past January's latest forecast.
Okay. Have you made any projections, I think, following up on Representative Adams, in relation to the projected shortfall in those January estimates? Have you any figure what that 30% would be at this date?
May I respond, Mr. Chairman? No, we have not made any new projections. Some of the information on which those projections must be based has not yet come in, and so we are not able responsibly to make a projection.
Okay, then the department's request was roughly $86.2 million for municipal assistance. Was that it?
That's correct.
And what was the governor's recommendation? Do you have those figures?
what is in the budget before you is the governor's recommendation. It is. It represents approximately a 6% increment over last year's appropriation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mixtad.
Commissioner, on your bill for Games of Chance, when is that proposed to be introduced?
We have been pushing, Mr. Chairman, we've been pushing to get it completed, and we're hoping to have a bill approved by the governor and submitted to you within 10 days or 2 weeks. I can't
so
guarantee that, but we are working and pushing.
Early this session.
Oh, yes, and very shortly.
Who in your office is working on it?
Sally Smith, the Director of Public Services, is primarily in charge of ensuring that the draft is done. However, it's not going to go out until it receives full department approval.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Commissioner. Gentlemen, at this time, the gentleman can leave the table and we will leave Commissioner there. You received last week a copy of the resume on appointment, Commissioner Mary Department of Revenue. We have the five-day rule, and we brought up on Monday. Officially, Commissioner is going to be out of town, will not be here. And at this time, as I'm bringing up the confirmation of commissioners, at this time, the table is open to questions on the commissioner. Representative Ringstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I'd like to start with a real tough one. Knowing that you're from an area of the state that's got better weather, do you think you can handle all this stuff down here?
Well, I'll tell you, Representative Ringstead, I have the advantage of having done part of my growing up in Fairbanks and part of it in Juneau, so it's...
Well, I thought maybe you got smart going
back
to Fairbanks.
I did. When I grew up, I went back to Fairbanks, but this job was too interesting to pass up.
Further questions? Is there any questions to the commissioner? Is there any objections to the confirmations on Monday? Hearing none, we will sign the report on Monday as confirming you. At this time, I'm going to take up the alcohol beverage control. Congratulations, and we'll
thank
pass
you very
to
much, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. At this time, I'm going to take up the confirmations of the alcohol beverage control board. Two names that has been submitted to this group is Jack Griffin of Anchorage and James Nami. You both had those resumes to you all.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I have the resumes of those people that are on there. There's one new person on ABC board, right?
Two. There was
one was on several years ago, but
those were sent to your office also. And
will I still be able to ask any questions on Monday?
You want to take it on Monday?
I'd rather. Appreciate it.
We're gonna bring them in?
No.
I don't need to have them come in. I just haven't really looked at it.
Fine, we'll hold those off till Monday.
Thank you.
That completes Department of Revenue. The next one we'll take up is corrections. We'll take a 5-minute break. Let's go with the last one today is corrections. This will be chaired by Representative Cotton, Representative Hurley, and Representative Rieger. Commissioner, welcome to House Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Roger Endell, Commissioner of Department of Corrections. I thought I would attempt today to give you a brief overview of some of the issues that we're going to be faced with this year and in discussions with this committee and others about the department and its current accomplishments as well as difficulties. I brought along a few charts here. Maybe I can share those with you rather quickly. I'll back them up a little. Mm-hmm. This simply shows the black line represents the number of incarcerated people and the red those on probation and parole. The significant point is that sometime around 1980, 1981, the number of people who are incarcerated, it takes a dramatic sweep up off the chart. We in fact have 2,000 prisoners today, just over 2,000, 2,100 as a matter of fact. 2 years ago, it was half that. So in just a 24 to 28 month period, we have doubled the number of people in our facilities. I don't mean to imply that as a value statement, that is a fact. In terms of our budget, just a quick overview, it shows you that in fiscal year 84, our budget was $57.8 million. We had roughly 839 staff. Last year, we authorized $73.2 million, almost 1,000 staff. This year, our request is roughly $79.4 million, and it would take us just over 1,000 staff. So it's clearly a very, very quickly growing phenomenon. I guess you might call it a growth industry, not one that we necessarily would be proud of. This chart indicates the sort of a breakdown of the felony and misdemeanor population, and there's some changes by category. The number of people in Alaska institutions in 1980 was 663. 4 years later, it's 1714. Actually, today it's 2,000. I'm sorry, it's 1,800 in Alaska institutions. We have nearly 200 out of state. That's 683. We have quite a bit of growth in our community residential centers. This number should be increased also because we are putting some probation parolees into those beds. The number on parole and on probation, those numbers have also increased significantly. This breakdown here shows you how many people are in each category. There might be an easier way to get at that same information. Roughly 86% of our people are felons, 14% are misdemeanors. A year ago, I reported slightly different figures. It was 15% felon and 85%. 15% misdemeanor, 85% felon. So we are beginning to see a change, but it's really due to the drunk driving statutes. There is an increase in misdemeanors, but the felons are coming in faster. So the percentages you can play games with, but in actual numbers, it's clear that we've got a significant problem. The presumptive sentencing factor, we think, is important, but there doesn't seem to be a great deal of interest in studying the impact of presumptive and mandatory sentencing. However, our rough view indicates that people sentenced presumptively are serving between 30 and 40% more time than those not sentenced under presumptive sentencing criteria. This is a very quick view of our overtime situation. It's gone up tremendously. We have purposely in the last year tried to make a dent in that, try to cut it down. Some of this may be related to the fact that we have some problems with staffing and adequate numbers of staff and so on, but that's expensive. So we're trying to bring a few more people on board. At the same time, we're trying to force our superintendents to drop the overtime. It all gets down to beds, no matter how you do this. There are cheap beds and there are expensive beds. The most expensive beds are for the highest security prisoners. We're proposing to the legislature in a variety of ways that it's statute as part of what we call the Omnibus Bill. It's a rewrite of Title 33. It will be introduced in the House here shortly.